Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with revelations in the New York Times that Trump's lawyer John Dowd, who recently quit, engaged in obstruction of justice when he allegedly signaled to General Flynn and Paul Manafort's lawyers that their clients would be pardoned by Trump if they did not cooperate with Special Counsel Mueller. Jed Sugarman, a professor of law at Fordham Law School and author of The People's Courts, Pursuing Judicial Independence in America, joins us. He is currently working on anti-corruption emoluments litigation against Trump, and we will discuss a case against Trump International Hotel, now in federal court in Maryland, as well as the possibility that Mueller is now looking at Dowd. We will also address the hazards of working for Trump, which is apparently why Trump is scouring the bottom of the barrel in terms of legal talent, since it is likely that Dowd did things for Trump that could result in serious legal jeopardy or disbarment for Dowd, a situation which has prompted a lawyer who was considered by the White House for a job, George Conway, the husband of Kellyanne Conway, to troll Trump in a tweet commenting, "This is flabbergasting." Then we'll examine the latest court filing by Robert Mueller in which it is made clear that the FBI consider Paul Manafort's right-hand man in Ukraine, Konstantin Kalimnik, who worked for 10 years for the International Republican Institute in Moscow, and before that was with the GRU, is still working with Russian military intelligence. Scott Horton, a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security, joins us to discuss how it was Kalimnik who offered Putin's friend, the oligarch gangster Oleg Deripaska, who loaned Manafort $30 million, private briefings by the Trump campaign. Then finally, we'll speak with Philip Longman, a senior fellow at the Washington Monthly and the Open Society Institute, and author of The Best Care Anywhere, Why VA Healthcare Would Work Better for Everyone. He joins us to discuss Trump's firing of the head of the VA, who is to be replaced by the White House physician Ronnie Jackson, and the extent to which this change, which was championed by the Koch brothers' front, Concerned Veterans for America, is all about privatizing the VA to benefit bottom-feeding Trump cronies and Republican Beltway bandits. And joining us now is Jed Sugarman, who's a professor of law at Fordham Law School and the author of The People's Courts, Pursuing Judicial Independence in America. He currently is working on anti-corruption emoluments litigation against the Trump administration. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jed Sugarman.
Great. Thank you for having me.
And before we get into a discussion about the most recent court filings by the special prosecutor, Robert Mueller, I want to touch on the emoluments issue because a U.S. District Court judge in Maryland has just accepted a case brought to the court by the attorneys generals of Maryland and the District of Columbia. And the case is basically that hotels in Maryland and in the District of Columbia are being denied business because foreign visitors and foreign heads of states prefer to stay in the Trump International Hotel because they win access to Trump that way by sending money his way, which is against the emoluments clause of the Constitution. Are you involved in any way in those lawsuits?
I'm one of the amicus brief writers. We have a legal historian's brief before the court. So, yes, I'm involved, but I'm not one of the parties or the lawyers to one of those parties.
I see. And what do you think the chances are?
Well, they're much better now. It's great to have won. That it means that the court is allowing the case to proceed. The next step could have been that there would be depositions and more subpoenas for the Trump organization to provide documents and explain what's going on. I imagine the next step actually will be an appeal to the appellate court from this decision and then probably to the Supreme Court before any of that discovery will proceed. But this is the step, at least one step along the way, for the court, allowing for much more information to come out.
So turning to the latest court filing by the special counsel, Robert Mueller, first of all, I spoke with a former federal prosecutor just the other day who made the point that the special counsel is not operating under the statute that Ken Starr operated under. And there's no obligation at the end of the day for his report to even be made public. So the suggestion was that the way we're learning about what's happening in this very closed and secret investigation is through these court filings, which are quite extensive. So the latest court filing is essentially to do with an attorney, Alex van der Zwaan, who was working for a big white shoe law firm in London, and he lied to the special prosecutor about communications he'd had with Manafort. And his deputy, Kalimnik, who turns out to be a GRU, Russian military intelligence officer, which is an issue we're about to get into in the second segment following you, Jed.
Right. So it's a very significant development. It's the biggest connection for what we call collusion so far that Mueller's posted. People have talked about, or there have been reporting about Don Jr. and Kushner and the Russian lawyer, Veselnitskaya. People have been looking at Roger Stone and his connection with Guccifer 2.0. Mueller hasn't weighed in on those cases yet. But in this filing, this is the closest connection he has established between the Trump campaign and Russian intelligence. So in this filing, he says that the FBI has concluded, or is comfortable concluding, that this person A, Konstantin Kalimnik, was at the time a Russian intelligence officer, and he was in direct communication with Rick Gates, the deputy campaign manager and then the liaison from the Trump campaign to the Republican National Committee. You know, Gates was a pretty high-up official in the Trump campaign, which means that what Mueller is alleging is coordination and conversations between high officials in the Trump campaign and Russian intelligence. So that's a hugely significant piece. And not only was person A, Kalimnik, likely to be a Russian intelligence officer, what the filing also tells us is that both Alex van der Zwaan and Rick Gates understood that he was a Russian intelligence officer during these communications. This wasn't just accidental. This was, at least as alleged in these documents, they knew exactly what they were doing. So that is a huge piece of the criminal liability of this investigation.
But it leads me to the other story, which I wanted to talk to you about, which is the fact that now, according to the New York Times, it appears that John Dowd, even though he denies it, who recently quit from the president's legal team, he apparently floated a suggestion of a pardon to both General Flynn's lawyer and to Manafort's lawyer, which could be considered obstruction of justice. It's obvious, at least to me, that Manafort is holding out for a pardon because he's hanging tough. But the fact that he got so furious when he learned that Rick Gates had flipped would indicate to me that now, in effect, they may not even need Manafort. Little wonder Manafort is furious.
Well, let me respond to two things you said there. One is that you think that Manafort's holding out for a pardon. I disagree with that. I don't think Manafort's holding out for a pardon because I think Manafort, I don't know that he realized this initially, but I think his lawyers do. A pardon can't save him. A presidential pardon is only a federal pardon. It only affects federal criminal law. And it turns out that given how many crimes are in this indictment, it turns out that New York State and many states have laws against all of this conduct as well. So even if Manafort were to receive a pardon from Trump, what would happen next is that the states, like New York, would turn around and prosecute him for state crimes. So I think that Manafort's holding out because he's in a no-win situation. If he agrees and cooperates with Mueller, he owes something like $20 million to a Russian oligarch mobster. It's not clear to me that Manafort believes that cooperating would necessarily endure and survive thereafter, or that he would have to then be part of witness protection or something like that. I mean, I think that's one way to understand why Manafort is not cooperating yet. And so that's one piece of the story there that I wanted to respond to.
And what about the idea, though, that Mueller perhaps doesn't need Manafort's cooperation now that he's got Gates?
Because Manafort is so much closer to Trump and what Trump knew. I mean, I think Gates worked with Manafort, Gates continued on the campaign after Manafort left, but Manafort was so deeply tied with the Ukraine oligarchs and Russian oligarchs, and was part of the conversations with Trump. There is some reporting that Trump believes that Manafort has much more information directly related to Trump than Rick Gates does, and so that's why I think the filing yesterday is so significant. It turns up the pressure on Manafort to cooperate. I mean, Manafort is looking at something like 300 plus years behind bars. Obviously, he's looking at what would effectively be a life sentence. So at some point, he's going to have to make some tough decisions about whether he's going to be spending the rest of his life behind bars or the rest of his life with FBI protection.
Right. So are you safer in prison from Deripaska?
Exactly.
You know, that's what it comes down to.
Look how many Russians are turning up with a little extra polonium tea over the last few months. I mean, it's quite remarkable, that Putin, I think, is actually sending a signal not just to Russians, but I think he's sending a signal to the American co-conspirators for them to keep quiet as well.
And again, I'm speaking with Jed Sugarman, a professor of law at Fordham Law School and the author of The People's Courts, Pursuing Judicial Independence in America. He's currently working on anti-corruption emoluments litigation against the Trump administration. Now, just back to Dowd, who quit recently, and of course, it's pretty obvious that the president's finding it hard to find personal lawyers. The only one that he has, Sekulo, basically has represented religious rights, evangelical institutions in so-called religious freedom cases. Sekulo seems to have found a colleague in Georgia who has even less experience from what one can tell. So they're not looking particularly good in terms of their legal ammunition. And there was a lot of criticism of Dowd himself. He sent out a tweet that could also get him into trouble. But in general, let's get to the issue of whether or not the special counsel could be zeroing in on Dowd now. What's your sense of that?
Well, I think there are two things you mentioned that put him in legal jeopardy. One was the set of tweets in December where Dowd said that, it was under Trump's Twitter account, and Trump tweeted, "I had to fire Flynn because he lied to the FBI." And it turned out that tweet was basically a confession to obstruction of justice. Because keep in mind, Comey has testified that Trump asked him later, you know, after he fired Flynn, to let Flynn go. Can you see the letting him go? That was a direct quote. Well, if Trump knew, at the time, Trump basically said, I knew that he lied to Pence, Vice President Pence. Well, lying to Pence is not a crime. And if that's all that Trump knew at the time, it's not like he was trying to cover up necessarily criminal behavior by Flynn. But once Dowd, his own lawyer, tweets out, I had to fire Flynn because Flynn lied to the FBI, and puts that in Trump's mouth, now Trump has just put himself into a confession that he knew Flynn had broken the law and then asked Comey to, quote, let him go. And that is a much harder, that's a lot of legal jeopardy, a lot stronger case for obstruction of justice. So what Dowd has to answer to is first why he shouldn't be disbarred. I mean, he claimed later that he wrote that tweet and Trump didn't know about it. I mean, he's either lying about that Trump did know or Trump did tweet it and he's trying to take the fall. That lying isn't okay. Or he's tweeting out semi-confessions of his clients, and that's not okay either. So Dowd is in trouble for his professional life. But I'd also argue that, you know, a lawyer, it does not have any privilege to deliver a bribe for a client. Nor does a lawyer have the privilege to help his client obstruct justice. And offering pardon to try and buy people's silence, which is arguably what was happening here with Manafort and Flynn, that makes Dowd a co-conspirator to obstruction of justice. It's quite possible that Dowd, in fact, resigned because the story was in development in the New York Times, and he resigned to get out ahead of the story and get out. So I think that this certainly makes him, this gives Mueller leverage to sit down and talk with Dowd, because, you know, the attorney-client privilege does not apply if you are in a conspirator in breaking the law, and who knows what else Dowd also co-conspired with Trump to do illegally.
And so far, what we've heard from Dowd is not exactly convincing. He said there were no discussions, period. As far as I know, no discussions. So, again, the caveat, as far as I know. What did you make, though, of the reaction from Kellyanne Conway's husband, who was a lawyer whose name was floated as a possible member of Trump's legal team?
I don't imagine that Kellyanne Conway's husband is going to think about this. He's been tweeting about what a chaotic and unmanageable client Trump would be from the perspective of his wife, Kellyanne Conway, joining the team. I think what you're seeing here is that no lawyer with a professional reputation is saying yes to this client for a number of reasons. Just like with Dowd, working for Trump can threaten your professional career by risking disbarment or potentially worse with being implicated in crime.
What is your sense then of back to the question that I brought up earlier, based on an interview I recently did a few days ago with a former federal prosecutor, that basically what these court filings that are being put out by Mueller are really a way to get the story out to the public as much as he can, even though he's being very professional and very secretive? Because you do get a lot of details in these court filings, and you're beginning to see more and more of the mosaic making the bigger picture clearer. Do you agree with that?
I generally disagree with that. I generally think that Mueller has been keeping his cards very close to his chest. We know that he's picking up a lot of information along the way, and he's only using it very, very carefully. So I think as he's issuing these indictments, these indictments show some of what else is going on, but they tell only a limited story each time. He's not issuing a giant report with each of these indictments or with each of these guilty pleas. Nevertheless, he is using them to show that he's got the goods. Every time he brings an indictment, they look very solid. And in this last filing, when it shows what he knows about Gates and van der Zwaan in communication with the Russian intelligence officer, he probably didn't have to include all of that, given that van der Zwaan had pled guilty to a false statement already. I imagine he's showing the hard evidence, or that he's got hard evidence in that case. Keep in mind, Gates, in the previous filing about van der Zwaan, the filing said that van der Zwaan recorded that conversation with Kalimnik, the Russian intelligence officer, or person A. I would interpret that to mean that Mueller is doing what your prosecutor friend thought he was doing. He's telling the world that he may have a recording of a Russian intelligence officer talking to van der Zwaan and Gates. I'd be very curious, and that was in September of 2016, just 2 months before the election. I'd be very curious about why van der Zwaan recorded that conversation and lied about it. It probably has something interesting on it.
Well, wasn't van der Zwaan angling for a job with Manafort?
Yeah, van der Zwaan's father-in-law is one of the presidents of the bank, Alpha Bank, that had been in this mysterious secret communication with Trump Organization servers. So van der Zwaan might be quite deeply implicated, or knows much more about this than the public knows, and he may be telling Mueller. So that's what, when we see these guilty pleas, we see what the person is pleading guilty to, but we don't see what they are willing to testify about. And so as this moves forward, we will the first prosecutions that we see, if Manafort goes to trial, then we're really going to start seeing witnesses start telling more of their story. But until then, it's a very careful set of nuggets that give us a preview, but not much detail yet about what Mueller knows.
Well, Jed Sugarman, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for the opportunity to talk. I appreciate it.
And again, I've been speaking with Jed Sugarman, who's a professor of law at Fordham Law School and the author of The People's Courts, Pursuing Judicial Independence in America. He's currently working on anti-corruption emoluments litigation against the Trump administration. We're going to take a brief station break and back examining Paul Manafort's right-hand man, Konstantin Kilimnik, who worked for 10 years for the International Republican Institute in Moscow and, according to the FBI, is still working with Russian military intelligence. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Scott Horton, who's a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. He serves on the American branch of the International Law Association and has represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers. Welcome to Background Briefing, Scott Horton.
Great to be with you.
And in this latest court filing by Special Counsel Mueller, there's quite a bit of information coming out in the filings about Alexander van der Zwaan, a lawyer who worked for a big law firm in London who was angling for a job with Manafort. And I believe this lawyer is related to the owners of Alpha Bank, which is a huge Russian bank that had a server in Trump Tower that there's been a lot of suspicion about, a possible back channel. But our previous guest mentioned that he thought that what Mueller might have been hinting at in the court filings, I broached the notion that from a conversation I just recently had with the federal prosecutor that Mueller is putting out a lot of information in these court filings because that's his way of letting the public know about what he's up to as much as he's being very secretive. So at least if he gets shut down, there's a lot of information already out there. I don't know whether that's you agree with that or not. But do you think, as our previous guest indicated, that Mueller may have tapes of this conversation with Konstantin Kilimnik, the ex-GRU Russian military intelligence officer who was Manafort's deputy in Ukraine?
I think it's very clear at this point that he has highly reliable alternative accounts of what happened, which he's received from other sources. Now, that may be intercepts, it may be other witnesses, people who were present in the conversation, or it might be tapes of the conversation. I agree with the proposition that this is Mueller putting out on the record things that people need to know. I mean, you know, I think so if you look at, you know, the ethical practices of prosecutors and Department of Justice, you know, they shouldn't be leaking things to the press. But they are entitled to speak to the court, with candor, and to include in their representations to the court things that they believe the public need to know. And I think this falls into that category. So this is basically telling you that, you know, there was a very long track record of communication going on between both the people at the top of the campaign, Manafort and Gates, and a person that the FBI has established is still a Russian military intelligence officer, and that person, of course, is Konstantin Kilimnik.
Well, it's significant, surely, because the GRU, Russian military intelligence, are the people that apparently hacked the DNC and Podesta, Hillary Clinton's campaign manager's email, and got it to WikiLeaks. So they played an extraordinarily important part. Now we're learning from tests before the UK Parliament yesterday from Christopher Wylie, the whistleblower on Cambridge Analytica. He suggested that Alexander Kurgan, the Russian academic who made the deal with Facebook to get all this data, which was used by the Trump campaign to help win in those three key swing states using Facebook and Cambridge Analytica's psychographic or whatever they call it, targeting. So this testimony yesterday before the UK suggested that Kurgan was a go-between with the GRU. So that kind of completes the loop, doesn't it?
It does. And in fact, the suspicion about Alexander Kurgan has been there for a long time. And note, one of the major things he's doing there is working under a contract with Lukoil. Lukoil, the major Russian oil company, which in fact is headed by individuals who are in the Russian intelligence service. So it's pretty clear. I think if we think back now, about 2 years, a year and a half ago, there was a big article that ran in the Financial Times talking about a concern within the UK government that there was a concerted effort to penetrate the intelligence circle at Cambridge. I mean, Cambridge University has always been a big center for intelligence studies, but also for seminars and discussions by UK intelligence figures. And it's very, very clear that the Russians were making a concerted effort to get a foot in the door. And I think the name of Alexander Kurgan, of course, came up many, many times as one of the people under suspicion of being involved in that effort, along with a number of other people.
Right. Well, we remember that General Flynn, the short-term first national security advisor, he went to some seminars at Cambridge and was seduced by a young Russian woman who was supposedly doing her doctorate or something at Cambridge. And I think that was my darling Misha. Remember those communications?
General Misha, yes, yeah, indeed. The love emails, which subsequently turned up.
Right.
So, I mean, she was clearly involved in a recruitment effort targeting Flynn, who became National Security Advisor. And that's something I suspect got reported back to Flynn's masters in the U.S. and was one of his big problems in the last phase of his career as director of DIA.
So again, I'm speaking with Scott Horton, who's a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. He serves on the American branch of the International Law Association and has represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers. So, Scott, how do you think we're doing in terms of convincing the incredibly stupid elements in the American left that watch RT and still believe that all of the Russian propaganda, the latest of which is that the poisoning of this former Russian spy who was with the GRU and his daughter in Salisbury was done by the Brits because Porton Down is where they did chemical weapons and bio research, this Cold War relic, that somehow Novichok, the Soviet era nerve agent, came from the Brits and was used against these people. And I get email from all these morons who send me this stuff all the time. I mean, what in God's name would the motive of the British government be to poison their own first responders along with these Russians? What would they get out of it? I mean,
and to do it in such a sloppy way that there are several hundred people in the town of Salisbury who picked up traces of this extremely dangerous chemical agent. No, I think that point is very, very clear. But again, it goes back to the entire nature of the Russian active measures campaign. And that's a campaign that is designed to play the two extremes off against the center. So to build distrust on both sides of your own government, of its truthfulness, and to foment instability and mayhem as a result. That's the core strategy, and I think we have to say that strategy is working and it's pretty effective. And if we see how that message has come out, you know, it came out first on Russian media domestically, then it was in RT and Sputnik, and then we've got, you know, we have hundreds of these of these news aggregator sites all over the place, which seem to be sort of vaguely left-wing or vaguely right-wing, that instinctively, reflexively repeat these messages coming from RT. So on the right, we have InfoWars, for instance. On the left, we have groups like the Duran and Zero Hedge and Russia Insider, three quite prominent ones, each of which has been investigated and revealed to be funded by the Russian Ministry of Propaganda. But I think we have on the left in the U.S. an awful lot of people who follow those sites and accept the message they put out. So they're uncritical consumers of propaganda.
Well, you know, that's not to say that, in fact, I think the even worse is that we have a propaganda organ here in the United States. It's known as Fox News, and it works in concert with the Trump administration. And you'd think that these people would recognize that. What would it be like living in a country where all you had was Fox News? That's what it's like in Russia.
Well, I would say Russia is not as crude as that, but I have recently had visitors come to me from Uzbekistan who watched American television and looked at Fox News and commented to me afterwards that we just don't understand it. Of course, we have news broadcasts that are exactly like this at home, but we don't understand why people, given the free choice to listen to something else, would choose to listen to this. And that's a very good question.
Well, that's a question that we should put to Rupert Murdoch. You know, he's a volunteer ministry of truth for the Republicans and for the Trump administration. At least during the Cold War, the TASS and Pravda journalists were forced to print what the government told them. But in a free country, the idea that they volunteer to be propagandists for the government is so un-American and so disgusting.
Well, that's exactly right, and it's particularly ironic with Rupert Murdoch, who, you know, launched his career on the left, migrated to the right, and now seems to be, you know, working in concert with not only with Trump, but also with the Kremlin on a number of things. But, you know, it's interesting. We haven't seen or heard much from Rupert Murdoch since December, roughly. He seems to have disappeared off the scene, and I begin to wonder what's happened with him.
Well, but his organization is essentially the co-presidency, because if you look at how, I've mentioned this before, but I get so much solicitation from right-wing groups and think tanks and PR fronts to interview people with all these crazy ideas that are out there in the right-wing Fox News echo chamber. But it's orchestrated. You know it's orchestrated because the same stuff happened with the Nunes memo. I saw all this stuff developing, release the memo, and now the same crescendo is coming for Fire Mueller. This is not happening by accident. This feels orchestrated. And when you consider how many people now Trump is recruiting from Fox directly, I mean, of course, DeGenova and his wife, they showed up in person at the White House and apparently looked a bit disheveled. And Trump thought, my God, they look so much better on Fox, and immediately withdrew the invitation to hire them. So that's an exception. But the rule is that you have – I think you could make the case that Fox News is the Dick Cheney of the Trump administration.
Well, in fact, one program in particular, it's Fox and Friends. That seems to influence. If we go through his tweets in the early morning hours, they seem over and over again to reflect something that's just been covered and discussed on Fox and Friends. And he's tweeting about it, half the time not really quite understanding what they've just talked about. But just in terms of influence, it's amazing. There's never been a television news program that exercised such direct influence over an American president before.
So just back to the reason I called you, Scott, to talk about Konstantin Kalimnik, the GRU officer, Russian military intelligence officer, who was Paul Manafort's deputy in running his businesses in Ukraine. Actually, about a year ago, I think it was, I talked to Anders Aslan, a Swedish diplomat who served in Kiev and knew and knows Manafort quite well. And he mentioned on the air that his deputy was a GRU officer, Konstantin Kalimnik. So it's not exactly a secret. It's been pretty much in plain sight, hasn't it?
It has been. Of course, Kilimnik constantly insisted that he had been a GRU officer. He was no longer one. And I think most people who were observing the situation thought that that was not very likely. In fact, the way he behaved all throughout this period of working together with Manafort suggested he was serving the Russian intelligence services. And when we look at the Manafort emails that were picked up by NBC and I guess The Atlantic earlier on, and we go through them, he is facilitating communication between Paul Manafort and one of the most powerful figures in the Kremlin, Oleg Deripaska. His principal role in these communications is as a bridge, relaying messages back and forth. And, of course, Deripaska is someone who has the ear of Vladimir Putin at all times and has played a key role in putting together and overseeing the execution of Putin's strategies with respect to the West, especially the United States.
Well, what's extraordinary about Kilimnik's background, though, is that in 1995, he got a job in the Moscow office of the International Republican Institute, where he worked for a decade. So this is a guy that worked for the Republicans, in effect, for a decade.
I think that's absolutely right. I think, you know, as NBC, you know, Richard Engel from NBC did a program earlier about how Russian intelligence had set out to try to infiltrate and influence the Republican Party. This is, you know, one of many, many prongs, but there were much larger ones that involved, for instance, the NRA. So the Russians concluded that the NRA exercised huge influence over the Republican Party. They set out to create a liaison organization with the NRA, to pass money to the NRA, to bring NRA leaders over to Russia. Secondly, the Southern Baptist Convention. They thought the Southern Baptist Convention was hugely influential with the Republican Party. So they set out to recruit senior figures in the Southern Baptist Convention, bring them to Russia, establish counterparts for them in the Russian religious community, and so forth. And then we have a number of Republican office holders, too. I mean, Dana Rohrabacher certainly is an important one, but there are quite a number of others.
So let's just, in the last couple of minutes, you mentioned Deripaska, the oligarch slash gangster that's close to Putin. He's a key figure, and I think the M.O., that Deripaska used against Manafort is similar to what I think the Russians hold or Putin holds over Trump. In other words, these oligarchs slash gangsters, many of whom are fronts for Putin, they lend money to Trump. And in this case, we don't know about that because the report's not done yet, but that's the assumption. But let's just stick with the comparison with Manafort. Deripaska gave Manafort $30 million to invest. Manafort squandered that money. God knows what he did with it. And then Deripaska started to lean on him. And you do not want to owe these people money, I guarantee you. And he was squeezing him. And then Manafort got the job as a campaign manager for Trump. Suddenly, all was forgiven. The pressure was off. Deripaska then was promised private briefings by Manafort. They changed the Republican platform to be Russian friendly. And then the minute that Manafort was fired, Deripaska then put the squeeze on him again and has sued him for missing $20 million. Is that possibly what happened with Trump? You just don't want to owe these people money. And we know that Trump has stiffed every bank and everybody gave him money. He doesn't care about anybody, doesn't pay his bills. Is it possible that he borrowed from these same kind of oligarchs slash gangsters? And they're holding something over him? I mean, our previous guest said, you know, maybe Manafort, who's facing 300 years in jail, is safer in jail than he is on the street because of Deripaska. So in Trump's case, I mean, they would be perfectly capable of throwing acid in Ivanka's face. I mean, they're ruthless.
Well, and Deripaska himself was excluded entry to the United States for many years because he was persuasively linked to more than 40 murders in Russia during the Aluminum Wars. He's an absolutely ruthless figure with a homicidal past, so he's not someone to be dealt with lightly. All this information you reeled off, Completely correct. And this is information we have established thanks to Bob Mueller. So if you look at the original and the amended complaints he filed against Manafort, he laid out this whole story so we can see how it all works. And we know that the key figure relaying the message between the Kremlin and Manafort about how he was going to get out from this debt, how he was going to stop the enforcement measures and make good with Deripaska, came through Konstantin Kalimnik, okay, so the same GRU officer. And we know that Kalimnik told him, you put yourself in charge of the Trump campaign and you make regular reports back to us and it will be okay now. So that shows how it works. Now, with respect to Trump, I think, yes, this is probably parallels what's happened with Trump. I mean, we know from a number of different projects, it's very, very clear that there was substantial money from the Russian criminal underworld that flowed into these projects. I mean, Trump Soho is certainly a good example, and others. But there's also Russian state money that was flowing in. Remember the disclosure that Felix Sater made on Thursday, just a week back, when he acknowledged there was a signed term sheet for a loan from a Russian state bank, a VTB, to allow Trump to complete his project, the Trump Tower project. Now, it's a project that was put at over $400 million. So one assumes that this is a very, very substantial line of credit that was made available to him. So it's probably the Russian state also that's making money available. But, you know, there's not a lot of difference in terms of enforcement modality between the criminal underworld and the Russian state. And both of them, if you fall on the wrong side, they're capable of using the most extreme measures. It's not just a matter of going to court and suing.
Well, Scott Horton, on that note, I thank you for joining us. I appreciate it.
Great to be with you.
And again, I've been speaking with Scott Horton, who's a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. He serves on the American branch of the International Law Association and has represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into Trump's firing of the head of the VA, which was urged on by the Koch brothers' front, Concerned Veterans for America. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Philip Longman, a senior fellow at the Washington Monthly and the Open Market Institute, and the author of Best Care Anywhere, Why VA Healthcare Would Work Better for Everyone. Welcome to Background Briefing, Philip Longman.
Great to be here, Ian.
Well, thank you, Philip. And it wasn't a surprise that David Shulkin stepped down. He was a Democratic holdover and the head of the VA. He'd been in battle for some time. It looks like most of the negative stuff that was brought out about him was done deliberately by Trump appointees inside the VA who wanted to get rid of him so that they could get somebody in that would privatize the VA. That seems to be the MO. I think it's fair to say that historians will probably, at the end of the day, judge the Trump administration as perhaps the most corrupt in America's history. But these Beltway bandits and privatizers, that's something we've known for a long time. And, of course, in his op-ed in the New York Times, David Shulkin says that I became convinced that privatization is a political issue aimed at rewarding select people and companies with profits, even if it undermines care for veterans. And that's, we've seen that across the board with defense contractors, intelligence contractors, et cetera. If you're politically connected, you can just, you know, get a blank check and you stick your nose in the trough of the Treasury and just suck it up. It's disgusting. A friend of mine refers to it as Nigeria on the Potomac.
Well, under the mantle of choice, right, the Trump administration seems to be very intent on taking as much healthcare delivery out of the VA as possible and giving it to selected corporations that stand to profit from taking their business. So it's an old story, but one that's repeating itself.
But specifically, there is a front group, is there not, that's funded by the Koch brothers. It's called Concerned mm-hmm. Veterans for America. And they've been the front group pushing this. But what do we know about the veterans at large? I mean, from what I understand, isn't this the second biggest government department outside of the Department of Defense? And there are 370,000 employees in the VA, and they serve more than 20 million veterans. So I'd be interested in knowing how many of these 20 million veterans belong to this Koch front group called Concerned Veterans for America.
Well, a distinct minority, and many of the folks that are attracted to that kind of messaging, I think, would change their minds if they knew the rest of the story. So all of the major established veterans groups, the American Legion, the Veterans of Foreign Wars, have been strongly supportive of David Shulkin at VA and what he was trying to do there. Unfortunately, we're just not powerful enough to prevent Shulkin from being railroaded at the end of the day by people that do indeed want to privatize the VA. I would say that the order of battle here is slightly different than you might imagine. Yes, the Koch brothers have put a lot of money into standing up fake veterans groups like Concerned Veterans for America, but they're not really the heavies here. It's more the large corporate medical systems, hospital chains, that stand to gain tremendous amounts of business if the VA begins outsourcing more of its care. These folks are not, they don't have any ideological issue with socialized medicine or anything like that. They just want more government contracts. And to get them, they need the VA to stop doing so much excellent health care itself and to outsource it to them. So it's not really ideological. It's just profit-driven medicine.
So give us your case from all the research that you've done, Philip Longman, and particularly given that you wrote the book Best Care Anywhere, Why VA Healthcare Would Work Better for Everyone. You know how the VA works. There's obviously been a campaign to suggest that it's terrible, and there have been, I'm sure, a lot of the cases are real, that there have been waiting periods and stuff. There have been a lot of horror stories. Out here in Westwood, in Los Angeles, is one of the biggest VA campuses in the country. It's been run by a bunch of crooks for the longest time. They eventually had to, I think a bunch of them ended up in jail, but they had a hard time prying them loose. So do you want to start with the positive first or the negative? But address both, if you will.
Well, okay, let's start with the positive. So essentially for the last 15 years or so, academics and other disinterested researchers have attempted to document quality in healthcare and to make studies about who's got it and how. And in those studies, over and over again, the VA winds up on top is delivering better care. Better being defined by metrics like patient satisfaction, but also adherence to actual evidence-based protocols of care, not performing unnecessary surgeries, not performing surgeries that have dubious clinical value. And so from people that follow this professionally, it's really non-controversial and has been for 15 years that the VA, despite its reputational problems, actually is outperforming the rest of the healthcare system on most accepted metrics of healthcare. That said, now I turn to the negative, right? The VA is literally the largest integrated healthcare system in the world. It's got 9 million patients, and obviously bad things happen. Medical mistakes are made different places. The waiting times get too long. My counsel is that the beginning of wisdom on this subject is always to ask the question, compared to what? So whenever you hear that, for example, there's unacceptable waiting times at some VA facility, ask the question, compared to what? Because over and over again, when you find some deficiency at the VA, you will find that it's even worse everywhere else. So one way of saying this, it does have the best care anywhere, but that's not always so hard to do because the care is so deficient in so many other parts of America. So, you know, there was a huge scandal about wait times at the Phoenix VA in 2014. People got all worked up about how somebody might have to wait for 18, 19 days to have a non-urgent first consultation with a primary care doctor, right? And yeah, it'd be nice if we had a system that people could have a same-day consultation. And actually, in today's VA, that's quite common. But outside the VA, it takes people an average of 21 to 25 days in most metro areas to find a primary care doc who is still taking new patients, right? So it's bad. It would be great to make it better, but the solution obviously would not be to privatize it because it's actually worse outside the system.
But what about the issue of bureaucrats, some of whom are corrupt in the case of the VA campus in Westwood? They had a hard time prying them loose. I think Shulkin actually came up with a way to get some of these people out, didn't he?
Well, I mean, that's always a double-edged sword, too, mm-hmm. right? We have a civil service protections for a reason, right?
And
one of them is that so that we can have whistleblowers, that people, when real problems exist in an institution, somebody can stand up and raise their hand and blow the whistle and not worry about getting fired. And so those protections work both ways. It also means that when you have people that are incompetent or malingering or whatever, that, yes, it can be difficult to get rid of them. In my experience, the VA frontline employees are a self-selected group of people who could be making a lot more money working elsewhere in healthcare, but they have decided to go work for the VA because they have a mission-driven sense of purpose about serving veterans. Most of them are veterans themselves, and it creates a culture of service that just don't find in most commercial medicine anymore. So I think, again, there are problems in the VA. You've got incompetent doctors. You've got bureaucrats that are, in some cases, padding their expenses and doing other things that are bad, right? But remember, too, right, to ask that compared to what question? Your typical suburban hospital doesn't have an inspector general scrutinizing everything it does. It doesn't have two standing committees of Congress scrutinizing everything it does. It doesn't have a whole series of veteran service organizations scrutinizing everything they do. So when they mess up, you're not going to hear about it. But when the VA messes up, you do hear about it. It's a public institution. Every screw up is, by definition, news. But it creates an extremely distorted image of the VA. It's almost literally true that the image of the VA is inverse to its reality.
Well, the replacement that Donald Trump has named, Admiral Ronny Jackson, who's the White House physician, as it happens, somebody that's very close to me knows Ronny Jackson well and has worked with him. And from what we understand is that he may well have been chosen because of his good chemistry with Trump. I mean, that seems to be what's going on with Trump. You know, if you're either a sycophant like Pompeo or you have good chemistry like mm-hmm. Ronnie Jackson, you get the job, whether you're qualified or not. And yeah. nobody's suggesting that Ronnie Jackson has ever run a huge organization like this. So mm-hmm. we'll wait and see what develops there. But the one thing that caught my attention was, again, the op-ed by David Shulkin, who's just been booted out. He makes it clear that all of this fiddling expenses and all of this stuff in the press is all being put out by these people who want to get rid of him because they want to privatize the VA. He says, I quote him, "In recent months, though, the environment in Washington has turned so toxic, chaotic, disrespectful, and subversive that it became impossible for me to accomplish the important work that our veterans need and deserve." So I don't know whether we'll hear more from Shulkin. I'm waiting to hear from the former Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, who was clearly kicked out and was very bitter about it. How long can these people bite their tongue and not tell the American people what a chaotic and disgraceful working environment the White House is?
Well, I think both those gentlemen have a patriotic duty to tell the rest of us what they know about what they saw and what they were up against. It's really important. You know, Shulkin obviously did do some things that were dubious in terms of taking a vacation that he seems to have charged the taxpayers money for that he shouldn't have, but the amounts are trivial compared to the larger issues at stake here. And I think he's basically a good man who thought that by going into the, remember, he used to work under the Obama administration and was appointed by Obama, and the only Obama person that come over into the Trump cabinet, and he I think believed that he could do good from working on the inside and made some compromises that perhaps he shouldn't have. In the end of the day, you know, it turns out that he could not save the VA from Trump and from the forces around Trump, and it's a shame. But I don't condemn him for trying.
Well, Philip Longman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Well, thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Philip Longman, who's a senior fellow at the Washington Monthly and the Open Market Institute. He is the author of Best Care Anywhere, Why VA Healthcare Would Work Better for Everyone. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Bye.